is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, 50 years later, commemorating and learning from one of the great moments in history, the March on Washington for jobs, freedom, and civil rights. We'll probe deep into the significance of the massive 1963 march and movement it inspired with civil rights and labor historian William P. Jones. While in a resounding cadence, Martin Luther King lifted the crowd when he told of his dream that all Americans would join together to realize the founding ideal of equality. The very power of King's speech has also narrowed our understanding of the march, which Professor Jones reminds us was a moment of sustained grassroots organizing, linked locally to women's groups, unions, civil rights, and faith-based organizations across the country.
It was a movement of the grassroots. Professor Jones restores the march to its full significance of this emblematic event and the broader movement it propelled and what it instructs for building a movement now once again to march on Washington on August 24th to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the first march to demand the implementation of its still unrealized goals of jobs and freedom.
I'm really honored to be here. You are the people that I wrote this book for, and I hope that a lot of people who don't know anything about this story and don't really know anything about the left and labor will read my book, but I really wrote it for people who are in those movements. My initial idea for writing this book came from my own surprise doing research. I'm still writing a book on AFSCME, and so I was interested in the connection between the labor movement and the civil rights movement, and I had a fellowship at the Schomburg Center and spent a year going through papers at the Schomburg Center and discovered what I didn't know was that this march that almost everybody in the United States knows about through Martin Luther King's speech was actually organized primarily by unions and by union activists. And it was a movement of very much of the left. And this was something that I didn't know after, you know, getting a PhD in African American history and thinking of myself as fairly well read. And so that's why I wrote this book. And it's really a joy to me that I think the book is getting a much broader audience than the labor left, but it's really the labor left that I wrote this book for. So thanks for having me here. The idea actually for the March on Washington came from an anonymous black woman in Chicago. "Mr. Chairman," she shouted to the labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, "we ought to throw 50,000 Negroes around the White House. Bring them from all over the country, in jalopies, in trains, any way they can get there, and keep them there until we get some action from the president." Now, Randolph liked that idea, and within a few months, he was confident that he could get roughly 100,000 people to join him in a massive march on Washington. They would represent a cross-section of black America, as he said, described them, laborers, domestics, mechanics, and professionals. And they would gather at the Capitol building and march down Pennsylvania Avenue past the White House and the War Department and end with a massive rally at the Lincoln Memorial. They'd divide into brigades representing every state in the nation. They'd be led by Boy Scouts and veterans of the Great War. And they'd march behind banners reading, "Let American Negroes help America for total democracy. And if we are fit to fight, we are fit to work." As Randolph said, they would walk in a solemn and determined fight for real democracy. Now, many of you might have figured out that this is not actually the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, which occurred 50 years ago this year on August 28th, 1963, but it was actually the first March on Washington with which A. Philip Randolph called to protest employment discrimination in the defense industries during the Second World War. Randolph would actually cancel that march at the last minute because the primary goal of the march was met by an executive order that was issued by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This executive order created what was known as the Fair Employment Practices Commission, which was a federal agency to monitor employment discrimination by defense contractors. And the executive order made it illegal to discriminate against employees in the defense industry on the basis of their race, their color, their national origin, or their religion. So this is actually, the beginning of this story is a march that did not happen. But I think this origin story, which I recount in the book, is really critical for understanding the more famous march, the one that actually happened, and its continuing importance, I think, for American democracy today. From the start, Randolph recognized and insisted that this was an important victory, but it was only a partial victory. And there were two primary reasons for this. One was that the executive order was extremely weak. The amount of money that President Roosevelt provided to the FEPC, the commission that was charged with enforcing it, really allowed it to be sort of to embarrass employers. So they could hold, they had enough money to hold a few hearings, six or seven hearings in major cities. They started in Los Angeles. They had one in New York, in Chicago. And they would ask people to come and talk about being discriminated against. And so it was sort of a public event. It was really a PR event, right? And trying to focus attention, one, to convince people that this was really happening, that there was really discrimination, and to try to convince employers to do something about it. But it really didn't have much power to do more than that. Probably the most important thing was that it was a war order. It was an executive order that was issued as an emergency war order, and therefore it ended after the war. So it lasted only as long as the Second World War would last. And so immediately after canceling the march, A. Philip Randolph said, there's two things we need to do. One, we need to enforce this order on our own, right? And so that meant that he called on people who had been preparing for the march to go back to their cities, to their local communities, and mobilize people to go to these hearings. This meant going and identifying people who had been discriminated against, getting them, training them in how to testify in a hearing, getting them there, getting publicity, organizing marches and demonstrations outside of these hearings, in a sense trying to do the work that the FEPC was not really prepared to do. And then more importantly, Randolph said, we need to turn this executive order into permanent national legislation. And in fact, that goal would not be achieved until after the 1963 march. And I would argue actually was the most important achievement of the March on Washington. So this 1941 march really set the stage for the modern civil rights movement, and it established A. Philip Randolph as that movement's most important and most widely respected leader, something that would actually persist through the 1960s, but has been almost completely forgotten today. In fact, by the time A. Philip Randolph died in 1979, the Amsterdam News observed that he was not as well recognized as either Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or even Marcus Garvey, who had had died long before that. So he had sort of by the time he died in 1979, he had really faded from public consciousness. But that was not the case in 1963, and people recognized that he was, as they called him, the dean of the civil rights movement. So there's two really critical lessons or reasons that we have to understand the 1963 march as having its origins in the 1941 march. And the second one, I think, is particularly important for this crowd. The first one is understanding the goals of the civil rights movement. We actually, I think, speaking to a crowd like this, I'm not going to surprise a lot of people, but I think many people are not aware of the connection that from throughout the civil rights movement that that civil rights leaders drew between economic justice and racial equality, and the idea that those two went hand in hand and really could not be achieved in isolation. And that's something, again, that I think that many people on the left recognize, but the popular consciousness is that the civil rights movement was really just about winning sort of legal racial equality without these. Or that, and I think there's another interesting sort of popular belief, which is that the civil rights movement started out focusing on racial equality, And then over the course of the 1960s, it came to expand its focus to include economic justice. And one thing that I actually, again, was really surprising to me writing this book was the degree to which the story is actually the opposite. The story, it actually began with jobs and expanded to freedom or to addressing legal inequality. As Randolph said in 1944, no greater wrong has been committed against the Negro than the denial to him of the right to work. And the use of him is actually pretty significant in that also, in the way in which Randolph's gender politics did not change as much as, but they were changed very dramatically over the course of the movement. Now, this did not mean that A. Philip Randolph or any of the organizers of either of the marches on Washington, ignored segregation or the denial of voting rights in the South. It was not the case that they believed that economics was more important. And in fact, and a really important part of the story that I tell in the book is the way in which when mass movements start to break out in the South in the mid-1950s, people like A. Philip Randolph really saw them as potentially reviving the movement that they had tried to build in the 1940s and largely had failed to build a mass movement. And they were really impressed with, particularly with the bus boycott that broke out in Montgomery. And from the beginning, were directly involved in raising money for that and providing strategic advice. Probably the most important thing that trade unionists in New York City formed a group called In Friendship. It was primarily a fundraising network, largely among unions, to raise money to send to Montgomery and other places where activists were in the fire. They also recruited Bayard Rustin, who at the time was the most important strategist in Gandhian nonviolence. So there was always, and this is something that historians have, I think, ignored in part strategically, because there was initially a lot of charges that the Southern movement was created by Northern radicals, right? It was sort of infiltrated by Northern radicals. And so historians have paid a lot of attention to the indigenous roots of the Southern civil rights movement, which are very important. But I think in some ways they've forgotten or lost sight of the really important networks that were connecting the North and the South and were really integral to the emergence of the movement and the degree to which Northern trade unionists saw changing the South as critical to a broader struggle for changing the United States. So the idea that as long as there's Jim Crow in the South, you're not really going to get very far in New York or Chicago or Detroit. And so changing the South was part of a broader national agenda aimed at both gaining equal citizenship for people of color and also expanding the definition of what it meant to be an American citizen for everybody. So establishing that being a citizen means that you have access to a job and a well-paying job, to decent housing, to decent schools for all Americans. And this was really the primary message of the March on Washington, that it was for equality, but it was also changing the way in which all Americans experienced their citizenship. So the primary goals of the March on Washington really reflected that belief, which emerged out of the March on Washington movement in the 1940s. They demanded the passage of a civil rights bill that President Kennedy introduced earlier in 1963 that was focused primarily on legal equality. So the civil rights bill that Kennedy introduced demanded increased federal authority to enforce the Brown decision for integration of schools, to open access to public accommodations. And it had some very weak measures for enforcing voting rights. So the goal of the march was, on one hand, to pass that law, but also, and I think most importantly that we remember today, was to expand that law significantly in a number of ways that increased the power of the federal government to enforce this. And I think this is really important now when we often think of Martin Luther King's message being a moral message, right? That racial inequality is wrong, racism is immoral, and we need to convince people to change their morality or their mindset. When in fact, in many ways, Kennedy had already established that. When he, in June of 1963, he gave a very powerful speech in which he said, racial equality is a moral issue, as old as the scriptures and as clear as the Constitution. This is the president, and he said this before the March on Washington. What the goal of the march was to say, that's fine, but none of this is going to be achieved unless we have the federal government actually enforcing that, right? So we need strong laws that can enforce it. And I think it's important now, like, I mean, we think about the Supreme Court decision this summer over the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, specifically enforcement of Title VII. In both cases, the Supreme Court affirmed the moral issue, right? They said, you know, we believe in racial equality. Everybody should have the right to vote. Nobody should be denied a job because of their skin color. But then they eliminated the enforcement mechanism. So that's what I think is at stake today. The most important enforcement mechanism for most of the marchers was the creation of what was known at the time as a Fair Employment Practices Law, or this federal law that A. Philip Randolph had pointed to, sort of extending Roosevelt's executive order, which would ban employment discrimination. And this became Title VII in the Civil Rights Act, which now is seen by many legal experts as the most important part of that law. And that was actually a part that Kennedy did not support. Right? So this was very clearly connected to pressure from the civil rights movement. And if you read a lot of history, a lot of people will say, well, you know, Kennedy already supported this law. The March on Washington, I mean, over and over again, I read books that said the March on Washington really didn't have any impact legally. But this is the most important part of the law. It clearly would not have been in the law without that. In addition, they called for raising the minimum wage, extending minimum wage protections to agricultural workers, domestic workers, public employees, none of whom were included in the original minimum wage legislation. They called for a massive public works program to create jobs for all unemployed workers who wanted to work, regardless of their race. Now, the March on Washington didn't obviously achieve all of these, but I think it's actually really important. There's two things that people on the left can do. One is to point to the limitations of the success, but I actually think at this point it's actually more important to talk about what was actually achieved, because the achievements were tremendous and we're very much at risk of losing them. Some of them we've already lost. In particular, the way in which the march was able to shift the conversation to linking economic justice and racial equality. So for example, President Kennedy had also talked about a war on poverty. But when he talked about the war on poverty, he said, we need to direct these programs toward poor white workers and the white poor because they feel like they're not getting any attention because of all this stuff about the civil rights movement. So he explicitly said, addressing poverty and addressing racial inequality are at odds, and we need to do them sort of separately. Johnson, when he took up the war on poverty, made exactly the opposite argument. He said that these two things go hand in hand. We need to address them at the same time. He described the war on poverty as an effort to eliminate poverty and racial inequality. And that was exactly the message that A. Philip Randolph and other leaders of the March on Washington were saying. And it was their influence. They spent very long periods of time with Johnson in the White House educating him on these issues. And he happened to be very open to them. So I think that was an important issue. But I think in the way in which they shifted that conversation, they added Title VII to the Civil Rights Act, which was the primary goal and had been since the 1940s. Activists in the March on Washington also succeeded in expanding Title VII to include sex discrimination. And this is a really complicated story. It was actually included initially by conservatives who thought that they could discredit the law. But it was actually black feminists, most importantly, Polly Murray, who said, and actually the response of many civil rights leaders initially was to say, this is a Trojan horse, this is going to discredit it, let's withdraw the bill and try to reintroduce it without this. And Polly Murray said, no, black women need this more than anybody else, right? Because black women are supporting families, and if we're going to make the argument that supporting a family is necessary, or the ability to support your family is essential to being an equal citizen, then we need to make this more than ever. And they actually, again, I think, really were able to shift this conversation. The march also laid the groundwork for the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and I think also in the degree to which the war on poverty was robust, and the fact that it was the greatest increase in federal support for education, healthcare, and housing since the New Deal. And again, I think these are things that often on the left are discounted or saying, well, you know, the war on poverty, it wasn't all we wanted. It was sort of detracted by the war in Vietnam. But it actually was, and particularly, you know, as we get farther and farther away from it, we realize how precious it was, right? So I think we need to really celebrate that as a victory. So one reason that I think it's really important to have this long perspective on the march is the way in which we understand what its goals were. The second one, this is the one that I think is particularly important for us, is giving us a perspective on the long process of organizing. What went into actually creating this massive mobilization that, again, in the mainstream media is often described as a sort of spontaneous event. You know, Martin Luther King said, come to the Lincoln Memorial, and everybody was there. But as we see, as it's clear, is that this was the result of over two decades of really serious organizing. And I think that's particularly important for us to remember today. The March on Washington was actually the first idea for the 63 March came from the Negro American Labor Council. It was a network of thousands of black trade unionists across the country today. It's almost completely forgotten. In some ways, it's a predecessor to the CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. And their initial plan was actually to march on the headquarters of the AFL-CIO to protest discrimination within organized labor. But they were persuaded for a number of reasons to expand their focus and shift it to the government. There were two processes that I think are important of expanding this focus. One was the embrace of the civil rights movement in the South. And that was largely due to another New Yorker, Anna Arnold Hedgman, again, another completely forgotten New Yorker, who had actually worked very closely with Randolph since the 1930s. She was the leader of the YWCA. She actually said to Randolph, who Randolph was the president of the Negro American Labor Council, he went to her and a number of civil rights leaders and said, let's have a march for jobs on Washington. And she said, that's a great idea, but you know, there's this movement in the South that we should probably pay some attention to. Why don't you meet with Martin Luther King? She arranged a meeting between the two, and when they emerged from that meeting, they said, let's have a march for jobs and freedom. So again, it started with jobs. It expanded to include these goals of integration and access to voting rights in the South. And this really formed an alliance between the Negro American Labor Council, which was largely Northern black trade unionists, and the SCLC and SNCC in the South. And that's something that I think is really important, again, that we remember. This was begun as by black radicals. It was a relatively small group of black leftists. Then they expanded to include moderates, both black and white. So they went to the NAACP, they went to the Urban League, they went to the union movement. And from both black and white moderates, they got a lot of resistance. We don't want to organize a mass march at a time when Kennedy's bill might be passed. This is going to derail this effort. And it was really Randolph and King, Hedgman, other within this initial group who convinced the moderates that this was going to work. And again, that's a long process. But I think, again, it's important to remember that this was primarily initially a very radical movement. It expanded to include moderates. But one important part of the story is that it did not become a moderate march. And if anything, the radicals were able to pull the moderates to the left. It remained an incredibly radical and powerful march. The AFL-CIO continued to refuse and did not ultimately endorse the march, although they actually did play a very important role immediately after the march in lobbying for the Civil Rights Act, I think largely because they were embarrassed. This actually, in addition to being the largest civil rights march in U.S. history, was probably the largest march of union members in U.S. history, and the AFL-CIO wasn't there. But they did get official endorsements from several major unions, the Garment Workers Union, the United Auto Workers Union, and local labor councils around the country. In many ways, it was union activists in New York City who played the sort of central role. 20% to 30% of the people who came were New Yorkers, and the vast majority of them were union members. The most important unions in the mobilization, District 65, the Warehouse Workers Union, the Garment Workers Union, SEIU, particularly the Nursing Home Workers, and 1199. And AFSCME, District 37, was actually really consistently at the center of organizing. They were actually central to raising money for the Montgomery bus boycott and to send Bayard Rustin to Montgomery in the 1950s, and remained really central to this movement. So I think we need to remember the goals of the march and the sort of and the radicalism of those goals, and the degree to which I think the march was successful in at least achieving significant parts of those goals. As we look back on this history 50 years ago, there are important lessons that we can learn about the importance of organizing, the importance of unions. But I think it's also something that the left and labor needs to really embrace as a legacy of its own. I mean, it's a tremendous success that the left has to look to. The early 1960s, I think, in many ways was a moment similar to today. We have to remember it was a very conservative moment. It was a moment in which there was a sort of an idealistic young president who disappointed much of the left with his economic policies, which were what we would now call neoliberal, relied primarily on tax cuts and free trade to grow the economic. And actually, he actually called public works programs and wage increases old slogans from the 1930s. So on one hand, he's a liberal president, but I think it's disappointing to many who looked to President Obama for sort of a robust liberalism. And again, so I think I would draw up these parallels to today, and I think we need to really embrace this as a legacy and a victory, something that we can call our own. So thank you very much.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.